Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Julian, hello.
Hello, Nina.
How lovely to see you.
So nice to see you.
I'm so excited. We are here for something very special, aren't we?
We are.
The history of magic. So the basis is that it's about Harry Potter, the ideas that went into it, including some of the original manuscripts, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And what we've done here is we've taken the Harry Potter stories and we've examined and sort of investigated, explored the influences of magic upon J.K. Rowling. Mm. And we've looked at ancient history, mythology and folklore across the ages and seen how that's replicated in the books and how in many cases she's actually taken the stories and she's given them her own creative twist.
We have got a lot to explore, haven't we? And I know we're going to go in and we're going to have a look at, you've got some paintings here, you've got artifacts, you've got books and manuscripts. Lead the way.
We've got some incredible things there.
I can't wait.
And we're just entering the main part of the exhibition, but before we get there, I just want to show you these two wonderful paintings here, and I just want to explain that they're by an incredible modern artist. His name is Jim Kay, and he has been commissioned by Bloomsbury Press to illustrate the Harry Potter books, and he's currently done 3 of the books. Mm. So Prisoner of Azkaban has just come out, and here we've got Dumbledore on the left and McGonagall on the right. These are just a one stage in the creation of the final images.
So they're not finished paintings?
Not finished.
Right.
But Jim is very careful. I mean, he has told us that he has gone completely back to the books themselves in order to, there's lots of imagery in here, and obviously there's Dumbledore, he's holding his bag of
sherbet lemons.
But every single detail of his books relates in some way to the characters, and that's purely through his own reading of the books. So he hasn't been influenced by the films in any shape or form at all.
I mean, it's difficult for me. I think there's always a problem when you have a book in your head and you have characters in your mind and how they should look. Mm. And he's created a version of the characters, how you might imagine them. And I think the realism is extraordinary. I mean, the wrinkles around Dumbledore's eyes are absolutely exceptional there, aren't they? And he's clearly a very, very detailed painter. Mm. But they leave me slightly dissatisfied. I think
Jim would actually agree with you. I mean, he often does 20 different versions before he comes up with a final version. And he's been spending literally years on doing these. And imagine he's got 4 more books to illustrate.
I can imagine that the pressure on an artist to give visual rendering to this world, it must be extraordinary because the books are so well known, so well loved. Mm. The characters, as I said, everybody has their vision of Dumbledore and McGonagall in their heads. And it must have been hard for him, actually. I'm sure it was quite an angst-ridden process.
I'm sure as a commission, it was probably one, incredible, and two, the more it's gone on, he must be thinking, what have I let myself in for?
Absolutely.
I think he says that originally he expected it would take him 6 months per book. We're talking about years and years and years.
Really?
But he just puts his heart and soul into it.
And there are actually bits from J.K. Rowling herself, aren't there? There's little diagrams and things that she's
So got. In this particular exhibition, we've got a combination of original manuscripts and drawings by J.K. Rowling herself. We've got some modern artwork and obviously interspersed with British Library collection items, also artifacts like broomsticks and and cauldrons that we borrow from other institutions. But yes, we're going to look at some of J.K. Rowling's own drawings too.
This is my heaven. Many of the manuscripts, J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter,
Ta-ding!
I know, and art.
All in one go.
Oh, wow.
What we're doing now, so the exhibition has been organised into the different subjects that people might study at Hogwarts. So this room is devoted to potions.
I love these big books in the middle.
They're rather brilliant, aren't
they? They're amazing. And then this is a great space. I love the atmosphere in each in this room. It's so, it feels Hogwarts-y.
You feel like you've entered into that kind of school space, don't you?
And what is, look at this.
So this is
pride of place.
Yeah, I mean there are. I mean it's peculiar. There are no star items in this exhibition because, literally everything could be categorised as a star item. But this is a rather splendid historical cauldron, and it's called the Battersea Cauldron. It's named because it was fished out of the River Thames in Battersea sometime in the middle of the 19th century. Mm. And the experts reckon it dates from around between 800 to 600 BC.
I mean, it's so old, isn't it? It's so we're going well into Celtic Celtic territories. But the idea that you've got a cauldron in here, in a space that's discussing potions, I think that is a wonderful bringing together of objects, ideas,
of
books.
Of course.
And it's a beautiful thing.
Okay, it's got, it's beautiful when you look inside. It's almost completely intact. The rivets are splendid, the details.
It hasn't been blown up
fantastic.
From cooking up magical potions.
But you can imagine, cauldrons have lots of different uses, don't they? Mm. For making potions and remedies, to cooking and so forth. Mm. But, as an artifact and as an object, it's, rather astonishing. And I love to think that this is a kind of cauldron that Harry and his friends might have been wanting to use.
Absolutely, and I think what's so lovely from a sort of art historical point of view, the way it's put together with these rivets, it looks so modern.
Oh,
the idea it's been, presumably it's been put into the river as an offering.
There's
a lot of deposits in rivers because of, this animism, belief in animism.
It's a votive offering of some kind.
Yeah, exactly, the spirit of the river needs a gift. Mm. So it could have been a practical cauldron for cooking up soup. Or it could have actually been used for sorcery, some sort of...
For making a potion, or a remedy.
Or a remedy.
And think about it in that kind of sense, that potions and remedies, often, why are you going to be making a potion? It's in order to effect a cure of some kind, or to do something to make yourself lucky in love or something like that.
And in a way, this is a theme that I think must come through in this whole exhibition on magic. It's that strange world, the borderline historically between, I suppose, witches, how they're perceived, the borders between good and evil and devil worshipping and magic. But at the same time, going back historically to things like this, it reminds us that actually it's more about wise members of the community, doctors, remedies.
Yeah,
these are all roles that they fulfill, aren't
they? So making potions today might be associated with witchcraft, but in the past it's been... A typical thing that accomplished, skilled people like doctors and physicians might want to do.
Absolutely. And isn't there a manuscript over here that deals with exactly that, about apothecaries?
We've got a couple I want to show you. So this is the first one.
I love this.
So this is a beautiful 14th century illuminated manuscript. It's made somewhere in northern France.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the pigments have been preserved, they do look like they were made yesterday.
Well, French ones in particular, the blue that the French scribes use, it's so vibrant. And the thing I love about manuscripts, as I'm sure you do too, Julian, as a bibliophile, but half the time they're not open, they're not displayed to the sun and the elements. And that's why this ink looks so fresh, doesn't it? Yeah.
What you're talking about, let's look at on the page on the left, you can actually see it's an illustration of an apothecary shop.
Yeah.
So an apothecary being somebody who's going to be dispensing medicines and creating remedies for you. And you can see there's so beautiful shelves behind him, and those really, really ornate looking jars and pots of different kinds.
And I've noticed as well, they've illuminated with gold a couple of the pots just to give a bit of texture. It's incredible.
I mean, this comes from a surgeon's handbook, so it would be used to educate somebody, to provide instructions on different forms of surgical operations and different kind of remedies and medical practices.
And I think this idea as well, I mean, even there you can see the selection of different ingredients that can go into a potion, be mixed up. There is an alchemy here. There's a magic to it, in as much as everything has to be weighed correctly, you have to have the right amount of ingredients. And so you can see where the overlap into the sort of the magical and the mystical comes. But this is a practical guidebook to heal people, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. And lots of the objects in our exhibition are purely that. Mm. No, they are practical handbooks.
Mm. yeah.
There's one more we wanted to have a quick look at.
Right, show me, what have we got?
So this one, this is an early printed book, but what's so important about this particular image, it's the very first ever printed depiction of witches using a cauldron.
Wow.
And it dates from around the year 1490. It's printed in Germany. It was actually commissioned by somebody who wished to actually refute witchcraft.
Okay.
And but the illustrator got slightly carried away. The illustrator is shown two witches, and they are shown they're dropping a snake and a cockerel.
Yeah, I can see the cockerels being like shoved into
it's been
the,
literally been, into the and cockerel. They are in order to create a hailstorm. But what's quite interesting, I mean, if you can you describe the appearance of the witches to me?
Well, they're both rather ghoulish, aren't they? They've got these bags under their eyes and haggard looking.
Precisely.
I mean, they're quite grotesque, aren't
they? They're quite dynamic. And this image is rather important because it comes about the same time as the printing press is becoming popular. These images start to be circulated. It helps to demonise witchcraft, and also old women associated with being witches, so and leads to the fueling of the persecution of witches in the kind of.
I mean, this is it. If we're talking, what
early
is this?
Modern era.
This 1490.
Is late 1490.
And it does. It triggers off. I mean, this is we're going into the world of heresy trials, of burnings, of all sorts of thought crimes, aren't we? So because it's printed, it's easily disseminated, which means it's filtering out into society, and people are getting this impression of the connection between witches and devils, I suppose.
And it's really fueling the persecution of witches, and particularly elderly women, as being associated with committing witchcraft in the kind of like late 15th century and the early modern era.
So really, it's the power of images to affect how we see
things. It's very potent, isn't it?
Very potent, yeah. There's so much in this exhibition. I've seen something I want to see.
Okay, come and have a look at this. So Nina, this incredible scroll is called the Ripley Scroll. And it's about 6 metres long. We've never, ever been able to unfurl it in its full extent before.
Good God.
So we have a special case made to put it on display in the exhibition.
How exciting for you, though, as a curator.
Oh, yeah.
You must have been like a kid in a sweet shop.
It was one of the things that I actually said to the designers, can we please find a way of displaying the whole manuscript in its entirety? It was made around about the year 1600. Late 16th century anyhow. It's made in England, and it tells you how to make the Philosopher's Stone. And it's named after a reputed 15th century canon of Bridgerton Priory called George Ripley, who was a reputed alchemist, and he wrote a book called The Compound of Alchemy. And this scroll, in turn, is supposedly based on Ripley's writings.
Wow. Now, the reason it's exciting for Art Detective for looking at this is the artistry of it. It is absolutely beautiful.
Let's be frank, it's a bit bonkers, actually.
It's bonkers, yeah.
It is a bit bonkers. And the execution of it is rather, I mean, dare I say, it's a bit rustic, but that actually lends it this rather quirky, quaint quality. And you've got to kind of work out who this might be made for, and clearly somebody who was interested in alchemy and interested in the notion that you can not just turn base metals into gold, but you can potentially create the elixir of life as well.
Yeah.
There's this whole sequence of processes that you were supposed to undertake, which if you carried them out successfully, and believe me, no, we've never tried to do them, and I can't think we should try and achieve this at some stage.
Right, we need to put a weekend aside, we need to get this stuff.
But we need some ingredients, like when you come down, like dragons and phoenixes and things which are slightly difficult to obtain nowadays. Because what you're attempting to do is you're going to create three different stones, the white stone, the red stone, and the black stone. I'm going to show them to you in a moment.
Okay.
And by combining those, you end up with your elixir of life, and like Nicholas Flamel in the Harry Potter stories, you gain eternal life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely stunned by some of the imagery here, because even looking at these small roundels, there's the suggestion of sort of biblical stories, Adam and Eve, and Cain and Abel.
It's half based on fact, and it's half allegorical and it has philological elements to it as well, as you've noticed.
I mean, I'm intrigued here. So presumably we've got the serpent coming down in this rather gruesome form, actually. I mean, quite there's that story, isn't there, that you know, the reason that the serpent becomes snake-like is because its limbs are taken away, so it must crawl on its belly for all eternity. But this is in that sort of intermediary state with a serpent's tail wrapping out and then actually a limbed human at the end.
As you kind of identified, there are kind of dark elements to this as well. I mean, the whole notion, you're playing with nature, actually, aren't you?
Absolutely.
You're playing with nature by attempting to subvert it by gaining immortality.
All through this collection, you've got things that fascinate me. I mean, my research was all on bird symbols, but actually symbols, beasts, bestiaries, physiologus, these sorts of texts that go back and tell these, even back to Pliny and you know, his books on nature, they give you the as much as is scientifically known about something, but then they'll always twist off and become symbolic of something else, won't they? So they might be, as you say, with the serpent, that's resurrection or regeneration. Dove is peace and baptism. And so I love that sequence of connections from what seems to us scientific and rational, and yet becomes
it's borderline rational, isn't it?
It is borderline, but this is what's all across
this. And do you recognise this bird here? I mean, in the text it's called the bird of Hermes.
Oh!
But it's also believed to resemble, to represent the phoenix too.
Yeah.
And again, another bird which regenerates after,
Well, the phoenix is featuring heavily. So we've got this idea of rebirth, eternal life sort of coming through. And then this is the month
of mouth
of choleric beware. So it's about the humours, the balancing of the humours.
And then it says, here is the last of the red, and the beginning to put away the dead. The elixir vitae.
Elixir vitae, the elixir of life. I mean, this is getting so exciting.
I mean, it's really, really peculiar.
And then, it's really peculiar.
And then after we have our bird of Hermes, the phoenix, and it says down here, the bird of Hermes is my name, eating my wings to make me lame.
Oh my goodness.
Now this is rather interesting. So I don't necessarily Harry Potter fans would be entirely aware about this, but this is in the alchemy section of our exhibition. There's a reason for that, because the very first book, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, and J.K. Rowling herself has explained that the three father figures that Harry has in the books are named Albus Dumbledore. Albus is white. Then you have Rubeus Hagrid, red, and you have Sirius Black. Put them together and you create Harry's father figure.
My brain has just slightly exploded.
And it is rather interesting.
I like that.
That's a good example of how she wasn't influenced by this document in any way, shape or form, but when she was doing her thinking and her kind of research into writing stories, she was aware about these kind of things. She was aware about historical alchemists such as Nicolas Flamel. But I do love this, the fact that there's a connection between the stories and this scroll, which is 400 years old.
That is amazing.
It finishes off, and you know, it's got this verse in English: "Thou must part them into three, and knit them as the Trinity, and make them all but one. Lo, here is the Philosopher's Stone."
Oh, goosebumps. Da-da. Goosebumps. And, you know, the idea that this is already, 400 years old? 400 years
absolutely.
Old? That these ideas can still capture imaginations. I think that's what J.K. Rowling has done so efficiently.
She has.
But she's building on something that has tantalised people for as long
absolutely.
As we go back through
really
documents,
has done,
isn't
hasn't.
It?
Absolutely.
And we have another alchemist.
We have an even better.
Now, this has got to be one of my favourite paintings.
I know. I was just incredibly lucky. You know, whenever you're putting together any exhibition, and obviously the British Library, we've got literally hundreds of thousands of old manuscripts and printed books at our disposal. But in order to do justice to a subject like this, we need to borrow artefacts and artwork from other institutions. And in this particular case, this painting, which has been loaned by Derby Museum and Art Gallery, and you recognise the artist, don't you?
Absolutely. Joseph Wright of Derby, who I mean, a lot of people will know him from things like the experiments in an air pump.
It's science meets art meets industry meets
Absolutely.
Technology.
Yeah.
And what he does, I think, better than pretty much any painter, you know, bar maybe a Caravaggio, is play with light and create light sources and that sort of tenebrism of the deep
Absolutely.
Shadow and then just the shock
Absolutely.
Of a light.
The lighting of his painting is quite extraordinary.
Mm.
And the subject matter as well.
Yeah.
What is hugely interesting about this particular painting is it's actually based reportedly on a historical episode. So here, Joseph Wright of Derby is recreating a moment in which a German alchemist called Heligbrand, he's in Hamburg, 1669, and he's trying to create gold or something like that. He's doing part of the alchemical process.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, he's got this flask here, mm-hmm. which is bathed in light, and he's heating it up. And inside the flask, do you know what's inside the flask?
I do, but I want you to tell me.
It's urine, okay? Now, it's urine, incredibly. Like, who on earth have the idea? Who on earth, I still might speak my, who on earth have the idea? Like, to create gold, you have to boil up urine. But it was a good idea at the time. In the process, inadvertently, he discovers phosphorus
indeed.
By heating up urine, he's discovered phosphorus. So it's a real scientific discovery.
It is.
So it's a real crossover between alchemy, a slightly sort of strange arcane sort of pursuit, and at the same time with chemistry and modern scientific discovery, which is, you know, what was happening at the time with Joseph Wright of Derby, who himself was actually painting.
Absolutely. So he's painting going up to 1800. He dies in 1796, I think. But he is at this crisis point in English life, where all around him in Derby, you've got the white heat of technology, you've got the developments of steam and industry and things that are coming. And he sort of starts to represent that in his art.
Yeah.
But he always blends it together. So you've got the kind of the Gothic and the timeless.
Yeah.
You've got these symbols.
It's given lots
up
of
there.
Yeah, it's giving lots of Christian symbolism over the background here. I also particularly like the two I mean I describe them maybe as apprentices or assistants of some kind.
Yeah.
This very young boy is watching on and the way that he's on his knees and he's looking upwards.
But I think what's great as well is the expressions here, because this child's got this sort of wonderment and shock.
Yeah.
And his is almost divine.
It's reverential,
like
isn't it?
It is. It's like there is almost hallelujah moment.
And also, you've got moon just above him. You can't quite see where he's looking. Extraordinary creation, isn't it?
To me, it's
quite
fulfilling. I think it is the most beautiful expression of the coming together of the scientific, the fantastical, the mythical, the religious, and technology all in one.
Yeah.
And all through the paintbrush of such a skilled English painter.
Yeah.
He's just the best.
He's lovely. He's amazing. We're hugely thrilled to have it in the exhibition.
Yeah, well, you've got the most extraordinary collection of things here. Mm. There's still so much to explore. Mm.
So now we've left Joseph Wright and we're going to come into the herbology section of the exhibition.
Plant pots hanging.
I know, and this is one. It's difficult to say which is my favourite room of the exhibition, but I kind of like this one.
Yeah.
Because of the wealth of different items. But you can see fantastic printed books and you can see the plant pots hanging from the scene. And we're going to come and have a look at mandrakes over here.
Yes.
Because mandrakes are. They date back, obviously, the history and mythology around them dates back for literally hundreds of years.
But this stuff gets me so excited. I love botanical drawings. I used to go as a geeky teenager to paint flowers at Kew Gardens.
Uh-huh.
And so this stuff is just amazing.
Well, okay, this assemblage of items is... Now, I'm rather fond of this. We've got an Arabic manuscript dating from the 14th century shown you two mandrakes, but they were actually interpreted at the time as if there were two different sexes of a mandrake.
No.
So there's actually Mr. and Mrs. Mandrake.
Oh, that's hysterical.
I know. So, Mandrake and Woman Drake. And then we've borrowed from our friends at the Science Museum. This is a 17th century mandrake root. And this is where it all comes from.
Yeah.
Because the root resembles the shape of a little human. So it's been pulled out from the ground. You're actually pulling a little human out of the ground.
And in the books, of course, when they pull them out, they scream.
They scream.
To wear their
that
head.
Scream is fatal.
Yeah.
Now, in the Middle Ages, it was believed that pulling a mandrake out of the ground, it would scream, but the scream would just drive you insane. So it wouldn't actually kill you. But this is the kind of the masterpiece here. This is a 15th century illuminated manuscript. It was made probably in northern Italy, maybe in southern Germany, and it shows you how to cultivate your mandrake, and it's a particularly fairly peculiar process. Whether people actually did this, who knows?
Well, because we have here a fully naked man.
Mm-hmm. Who represents a mandrake.
A mandrake. And then what's coming out of his head?
So first of all, you have a leaf springing from his head. You have this, it's very gruesome, you have two severed hands coming out on stalks. They actually represent the fact that in the Middle Ages, mandrakes were used as an anaesthetic during amputations.
Really?
So there's a whole reason for that. Mm. But then this is how you actually cultivate, how you harvest it. You tie a rope around one end of a root, tie the other end around a dog, and you, if you look very carefully, you have to stuff your ears with earth.
Okay, your ears with earth. So I can see this poor chap here, yeah. And there's a trumpeting.
He's got a horn. He's going to blow his horn. And when he blows the hunting horn, it's going to startle the dog. The dog's going to bolt and pull the mandrake out of the ground. And in the process, obviously, you've got your ears full of clods of earth, so you're not going to hear it scream. One reason I chose this particular manuscript for the exhibition is that at this period, 14th, 15th centuries, there are lots of herbals being drawn and were often very realistic and lifelike in the way that they're depicted. But this one, the artist has kind of gone to town.
Yeah.
He's taken a few liberties. Elsewhere in the book, he gives roots of other plants. They kind of resemble little animals and so forth. How you harvest a mandrake, it's a whole kind of life story there.
But then we've got much more, you've got other texts here that are more scientific.
I want to show you why. This is a really splendid book, and this is entitled A Curious Herbal. And it was made by a lady called Elizabeth Blackwell in the 18th century. And there's an incredible story behind it. Her husband, Alexander, had been imprisoned in a debtor's prison. And in order to raise the money to have him released, she decided to illustrate, engrave, and have this book printed to raise the funds to have him released from prison. And she lived near Chelsea Physic Garden, so she did all the illustrations there. Then she had to take them to her husband in prison. He would identify the plants, and then she would add the captions and so forth. And it was printed over a period of 4 or 5 years until eventually she raised enough money to have him released from prison. And then what did he do?
Go on.
He left her. I know.
The cat!
Russia. But there's an even better part of the story, because he then goes to Sweden and he becomes the physician to the King of Sweden. But alas for him, he then becomes implicated in a political conspiracy against the king, and he's executed for committing treason.
Wow.
So he does have his comeuppance.
The wheels are cut off for fate again.
But just an incredible book by mid-18th century lady illustrator.
Yeah.
An absolute labour of love. And this is actually a copy that she's actually annotated herself.
But what's very interesting about how you've laid these out is the mix of subject matter and background.
Oh, exactly. It's very traditional in an exhibition to put two objects side by side which come from the same era, they tell the same story. What I'd like to do here is we've mixed things up. So we've got Chinese manuscripts over there, we've got 18th century printed books, we've got drawings by modern day artists, medieval manuscripts. We've even got the garden gnome over here.
Well, I love the garden gnome. I do love the garden gnome.
He's from
our
friends at the Garden Museum.
Is it?
I went to borrow a gnome from him. I could see out the corner of my eye, in the corner, all by himself, was this little chap here. Well, he's huge, actually. And he was their biggest and their oldest.
Really?
Garden gnome.
What age is he then?
He's made in about the year 1900. He's made by a German firm called Heisner, who were the world's first manufacturers of garden gnomes. In the Harry Potter stories and the Chamber of Secrets, Ron Weasley comments on the muggles that they love to have little garden gnomes in their gardens, which he describes as resembling fat little Father Christmases holding fishing rods.
Yeah,
there he is. So it does the job.
But then what Jim has done, of course, is depict how in fact, the conception of gnomes that's in the book.
They're described in the books as having potato heads.
Yeah.
And they're slightly grotesque in their appearance.
Well, they are, little, aren't they?
You know, like little roots growing out of their chins and so forth.
I have to say, though, I prefer these gnomes
to that one.
I love his. Those are great. I wouldn't have him in my garden.
Well, from herbology, we from need herbology. To keep exploring, don't keep we? Going. Should we keep on going through?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, the next favourite room of the exhibition is devoted to astronomy. I'm looking up at the night sky there. And again, this is a wonderful room. It has this amazing focus in the middle. Mm. It has this incredible globe. And then on the back wall over there, there's a, what I like to describe as a potpourri of all different wonderful objects relating to astronomy. I have a quick look at the globe first. Mm. It's a rather wonderful object in
itself. It's a celestial globe.
So it represents the night sky. Mm. It's made the late 17th century by Vincenzo Coronelli. We've done something rather interesting with it. Can I just show you?
Yeah.
So we've got this little device here.
Yes.
Which we've had made. And so let's pick on the constellation Draco. Connect the stars. Do you want to have a go?
Oh, wow.
And then it brings it out and it tells you something
Draco
about...
Draco Malfoy. The constellation Draco is named after the Latin word for dragon. Oh, how brilliant.
And behind us here, in front of us, in this particular case, just to name check, we've got Anglo-Saxon astronomical manuscripts on the left. We've got astrolabes, we've got books by Kepler, we've got a piece of paper which comes from the notebook of Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh gosh.
It's just like this, this great, great collection of different items and artifacts.
This is heaven.
And this one represents the constellation Canis Major, but particularly Sirius, the dog star. And in the shape of a dog, and there's a pattern poem written inside the body.
The fact it's Sirius, you know, you've kept this Harry Potter connection going.
There is a connection, but then again, of course, it goes back and it looks into, how, in this case, it's derived from, the Greeks and how they identified and named some of the stars in the night sky.
I'm so glad you've brought in other cultures as well. Mm. It's not just a look at Western civilization.
No,
it's looking much
purely
more
global. And it does underline the fact that magic in particular is a global phenomenon and it's been practiced and studied by people across the world for centuries.
I think that's amazing. And we've still got rooms to go.
We've got a couple more to go. So we're going to go into the next section of the exhibition. We're just going to walk through here. This is the room devoted to divination, crystal balls, tea leaf reading, palmistry.
There's too much to look at.
There's quite a lot, isn't there? And then slightly darker now. Ooh. We're now in a room which is devoted to defence against the dark arts and how to protect yourself against the evil eye.
Mm. And what I'm really excited about is this painting. Mm. I had no idea it was going to be here, and it is one of my absolute favourites. It's called The Magic Circle.
Yes.
By Waterhouse. Mm-hmm. It's a pre-Raphaelite-esque painting, mm-hmm. but she is just incredible. She's always captivated me.
Oh, yes.
angsty witch doing this magic inside this protective space.
She's making, so she's a sorceress, isn't she? And she's the landscape, she's on a, it looks like she's on a beach with the cliffs behind her. And she's making this protective circle around her, much like Hermione does in the Deathly Hallows, by the way. And in the centre of the circle, there you have, you know, she's heating up a cauldron. But behind, outside the circle, you have crows, ravens, and it's a bit
and they more can't come in. I mean, this is the thing. You've got that, that crow over there that's on the skull, and there's a sort of a burning coming out of the. Of the circle as she's drawing it with this very, very long wand.
It's a very, very long wand.
Yeah.
It's a very evocative painting, isn't it?
Mm. And the way, I mean, I just think it's so beautifully done. It's very naturalistic, the folds in her dress, but the way that her hand becomes the wand and she's intuitively protecting this space. Yeah. And then the suggestion of violence all the way through because she's got that sickle in her hand,
isn't
she? That's what's going to happen? Why has she got that? What is she actually protecting herself from? And I mean, I just think that the way that the posy of flowers is tied around her waist as well, so delicately painted. The more you look, the more detail you see. Each individual little petal there. But overall, it's just so atmospheric, isn't it? It's both strong and unsettling. You feel she's vulnerable in one way, but she's taking control.
Exactly.
It was an interesting one to get for this room.
Oh, we're very delighted to get this as well. We borrowed this from the Tate, so we're delighted to have that. So, a bit more sinister, this is a genuine witch's cauldron. Borrowed it from the Museum of Magic and Witchcraft in Boscastle in Cornwall. And it had exploded. And the story goes that there are three witches, they were making a potion on a beach in Cornwall. Reputedly they're trying to raise up an evil spirit of some kind and something went wrong and the cauldron exploded and was flung onto the rocks and they fled in panic and it was later recovered. And if you come and have a look, I mean, you can see it's covered in tar and resin after whatever was inside it, something went wrong.
So was there tar inside it? Is that what's exploded out? Oh my god.
So even, you know, even today people try and practice magic.
So it's relatively recently that this was happening.
Fairly recently.
Oh my
goodness. In
the
20th century, I believe.
In the 20th century?
I believe.
I love it. Oh, there's just, I'm overwhelmed because even behind us there's actual bits of Harry Potter.
This, for example, this is a very early aborted version of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah.
Where, you know, instead of starting with Dursleys, it starts with a minister for magic, Cornelius Fudge, and Hagrid has an encounter with him. And J.K. Rowling's gone on record to say that she did multiple different versions of the beginning of the first book before she quite got it right.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So a lost bit of the Philosopher's Stone.
No, it
just
amazing,
doesn't end this place. There's just so much to
see. Spectacular, isn't it? And now we're coming to, well, okay, so I always wanted to be a zoologist when I was younger.
Did you?
So I'm quite fond of this particular room. This is Care of Magical Creatures, and of course, but some of those creatures include dragons and unicorns.
I can hear them.
You can actually hear them.
I can see them.
You can see them walking past.
The room.
These are real, you know, that's a real hippogriff which is walking behind us.
There's Buckbeak.
It's just in the windows behind us.
Dragons.
We've got dragons, we've got owls and toads. And we've got the phoenix as well. I'm extraordinarily fond of phoenixes. I mean, more I've worked in this exhibition, and I'm particularly fond of this.
This is one I know very, very well. Yeah. I love this manuscript.
It's extraordinary.
It's an English bestiary. It's a 13th century, but to me, it's so iconic because it is one of the earliest surviving images in English manuscripts of the phoenix.
Yes,
isn't it?
Exactly. And actually, you know, it's also quite an impressive looking book. It's quite large. The decoration is quite, you know, it's quite cute as well.
It's well done. I think the initials are lovely. There's some very nice line work there in red and in blue. And then you've got, like you say, these lovely roundels.
And then you have the phoenix. And it, you know, there is named in red, F-E-N-I-X, Phoenix. And so the illustrations accompany the text, and the text establishes, you know, what this particular bird is. So
there's dragons around.
Hippie dragons. Now, of course, many of the animals featured in this particular book are also going to be real creatures.
Yes.
And then there's a crossover between what are real creatures, creatures which the artist has never seen, but has heard of, like elephants. And then you have animals and birds like the phoenix. Mm. And so there's a whole mythological story built up around the phoenix. In this case, it's very specific. It tells you the phoenix is a native of Arabia, and it lives for 500 years. And then towards the end of its life, it builds its own funeral pyre. And this is what you can see happening here.
Yeah.
It arises again after 9 days. Arises again after 9 days. And again, there's a kind of like connection between that and the resurrection of Christ as well. So it has, you know, theological significance as well. Mm-hmm. But the colours are fantastic. Those reds and that blue, greeny, it's kind of...
Yeah, the flames are so dynamic. I think this is, for me, this is a very iconic medieval illumination. Yet again, it's that bridge between different information, scientific information coming into England, being disseminated, being mixed up, wrapped up with Christian theology, myth and legend, and yet all kind of channeled through this animal, this creature that they don't know if it exists
I think, I mean, in the case of many of these mythical creatures, like the unicorn or the basilisk, you can guess in a very... They're fairly aware that they're elaborating and they're making it up as they go along, but it's just that storytelling element, isn't it?
Yeah, and the unknown. I mean, there's always that sense in the medieval world that maybe you haven't reached the edges of knowledge. Maybe there's still more
to
discover.
There's still something to discover. Yeah. And if the ancient Greeks believed in the phoenix, then why shouldn't I? I want to have my own pet phoenix, please.
And it becomes the symbol, of course, for the show.
It's the symbol of our show, absolutely, yes. And Harry Potter, A History of Magic.
Well, I have had the most extraordinary time with you
here. I've loved showing you around. It's been amazing.
This is a great time. Heaven. Manuscripts and magic and artifacts and paintings all together. Mm. And to be able to share it with you and have such joy and enthusiasm out
Thank
of it, it's
you.
Been amazing.
It's been huge fun, hasn't it?
Thanks so much.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.